Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Of all the reckonings to come out of the Me Too movement so far, the case of the R&B star R. Kelly has been a glaring omission for years. Allegations of abuse have followed R. Kelly for 3 decades. And to be clear, it's not the story of a star just hooking up with a groupie. Kelly has been accused of something like running a cult. Women have said that they were kept in his home as prisoners, abused physically and emotionally. A sex tape emerged and was viewed around the country, and it seemed to show that Kelly was molesting a minor. He was tried in 2008 and acquitted. Kelly has denied everything, and by and large, his fans and everyone around him have stuck by him. That may finally be changing because of a 6-part documentary called Surviving R. Kelly, which just aired on Lifetime. A Georgia DA is now investigating Kelly, and there were protests last week at his record label, covered on WNYC News.
We are tired of their silence. We are tired of the news cycle moving on, ignoring the brave testimony, stories, and fights of Black survivors.
We believe
Black survivors. We believe Black survivors.
We believe Black survivors. We believe Black survivors.
The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb wrote this: an expose typically indicts the character of its subject. Surviving R. Kelly indicts a public that knew of his character and did nothing about it, a public that constructed an elaborate architecture of denial and has chosen to live in it. Jelani Cobb sat down to talk with Dream Hampton, the documentary's producer.
Just want to start with a basic question, which is, who is R. Kelly?
He is both a beloved, you know, songwriter and singer who, I'm from Detroit, and he is someone who made music for Black people in the Midwest who do this thing called stepping, who have loved R&B, even as hip-hop came and went. Maybe hip-hop is still here, I don't know. But he's also a man who has had an open secret. And we've known who this man is for a very long time in terms of him being a predator.
You and I are in the same age range, and so you were one of the first people in our generation that was really kind of carving a niche as a music journalist. And one of the notable things about it has been your writing on specifically these questions of misogyny and sexism and the way that patriarchy has operated in popular culture. And I wondered, what were you thinking about when Lifetime approached you?
Quite frankly, I'm not a reality. I like cooking shows and home. I like Home Network, but I don't watch Bina Murray, and I thought they were going to do some silly reenactment thing. And when they told me that they were interested in a more serious approach, something that they'd never done before, I thought it was a time that I could redeem myself for a profile I had done of R. Kelly in Vibe magazine of 2000, where I just kind of wrote about his process. This was post his marriage to Aaliyah, but pre Jim DeRogatis writing about all of his predatory behavior and the lawsuits about him. I felt so whack about how that happens. Like my article coming out in November and then Jim's reporting coming out in December, that I never wrote another magazine profile on an artist again.
BuzzFeed has published an explosive report detailing accusations against artist R. Kelly.
According to the report, he's keeping a household of young women in a cult-like atmosphere.
The accusations coming from a 9-month-long investigative report.
And just to take a step back about this, when you say Aaliyah, Aaliyah was a 15-year-old rising R&B artist and under the tutelage of R. Kelly at the time, and then, of course, notably came out and Vibe magazine published the documents around it that R. Kelly had married her at age 15 when he was at that time in his late 20s.
And I think a lot of this explaining that you're having to do for your audience is another part of the reason that I did it. R. Kelly is uniquely our problem.
Mm-hmm.
And by our problem, I mean Black folks. He didn't really cross over. He had a crossover hit. Even the songs that he wrote for other people like Maxwell or, you know, Michael Jackson, and arguably even Celine Dion were R&B hits.
Mm-hmm. Going back 10 years ago, I was involved in an effort that had what I thought was a modest objective in my naivete, which was that we were requesting that radio stations not play his music during the trial. I thought that his music being played on the radio sent a very contrary message to young women who were dealing with issues of sexual violence and assault. And, you know, a group of us said that, you know, just for the time of this trial, his music shouldn't be on the radio. And the blowback that we got was so extreme. I look at it now as almost a kind of awakening experience. One of the things that you saw with him were groups of people outside the courthouse, and you include some of that in the documentary, the footage of that. But groups of people, very many of them women, very many of them young women, and they were there in support of him. And it was very difficult to hear anything to the contrary, that despite these allegations, there was very much a kind of closing ranks around him.
I wasn't following the trial as closely in 08, so when I did a deep dive for this docuseries, Geronda Pace, one of his more, you know, vocal victims, a person who broke her NDA, a young woman still, she's not 26 yet, met him as one of those 11th mm-hmm. grade supporters. So he was at his trial, on trial for having sex with an underage girl, and he was cruising 11th graders on that trial. The hubris.
Hmm.
And he grabbed me, and then we started kissing. And he started fondling my breast. And I stopped him, and I said, I'm a virgin. And he said, well, that's perfect. That means I get to train you, and I get to take your virginity.
So that is among a number of really heinous allegations that come up in the documentary. You know, physical abuse, sexual abuse, starvation, you know, people being isolated, kept from their families, and so on. What was the hardest thing for you to film?
Well, sitting with each survivor was a marathon kind of experience. I mean, it was hours on top of hours in a studio, just facing them. There was not one of those stories that was not hard. The stuff that as a filmmaker that I was most proud of, and in episode 5, I fought for every frame, and that was the rescue of Dominique by her mother, Michelle Kramer. And we've flown Michelle in to do what all the other principals had done, which was to sit in front of this green screen and talk to me face to face, you know, for 4 or 5 hours. And Michelle said, I don't want to come to the studio. She said, I want to look for my child. Legal told us we could not suggest this to her. We could only mm-hmm. follow what she was going to do.
Oh, right. Please, come home. She cried like a little girl just hurting for her mommy. And then I said, baby, how can I come back, please? And she said, yes, Mama, come back at 6.
One of the things that people got on the other side of it was, you know, criticism that they thought that was a kind of tabloid spectacle. Was there a reason why, you know, Ms. Kramer didn't call the authorities or?
Well, try to call the authorities about a missing person over than 18. Then tell them that it's an intergender, possibly romantic thing. Then tell them that missing person is a black girl. Mm-hmm. She has called the police. They all have called the police. I don't, maybe we didn't do a good job of like showing that again and again. They don't get a response from the police. You'll remember mm-hmm. that the police were called on Michelle Kramer. They called mm-hmm. the police on this mother.
Right.
So that the police are, I mean, it's this idea that they're like some, you know, there's some police squad waiting to drop out of the ceiling to rescue black girls is a fantasy. Quite frankly, I didn't know we were invested in until the last week on Twitter.
On this question about black girls and women, do you think R. Kelly would be a free man if the young women making the allegations against him were white?
I don't. But then I don't find that question very useful. You know, I think that people prey on people that they have access to. You know, this is the reason why the question by the right, the extreme right, the Stormfront folks and the Breitbart folks about, you know, black on black crime, you know, even that invention of that phrase is so wrong. And I know you've written about this. I mean, crime is committed in communities and who you have access to. And we should say that R. Kelly himself was a victim of crime in the most intimate spaces, his own home. You know, he was raped repeatedly as a child.
Does that complicate, I guess, this equation? Is there some other conversation we should be having about people who are themselves survivors of sexual abuse and the boomerang effect that that could have in someone's later life?
Well, I would never try to speak as an expert about sexual violence and abuse. What I have been told by people who are experts is that, yes, almost 100% of abusers have been abused, but not 100% of people who have been abused go on to become abusers at all. R. Kelly's 51. He just turned 52. And what I wish had happened back when R. Kelly was 27 and had had this illegal marriage, which was quickly annulled, to Aaliyah, was that his team, people around him, his record label, anyone, his family, would have done a deep intervention.
Do you think that the fact that R. Kelly was so cloistered within black communities explained any of the lag around taking these allegations more seriously?
I mean, I think that we didn't take these allegations, or that he was cloistered, as you say. One of them is we filmed a protest in Detroit of the Mute R. Kelly concert, and you see me outside of the concert asking people, do they feel any reticence to walk into this arena and give their money to this man who for at least 25 years has been accused of abusing black girls? And they, you know, had the art versus artist, you know, answer for me, and or that he's not guilty.
I am a R. Kelly fan.
It's two sides to every story.
I'm here for the music and nothing else. And
so there is this love that he has from black folks that is both a currency and a protection. And there's this very convenient way that we have talked about him being found not guilty as if he's innocent.
Say more about that.
Well, we know that black men are often targeted unjustly. In fact, it's a deep shame that black women have handing over black men to this system that we know to be both unjust and that targets them. At the same time, black women are black people, and we too are targeted and, you know, treated unjustly in this system. In fact, most sexual violence survivors don't find justice in this system, regardless of race.
So what do you think should happen with R. Kelly?
You know, I want justice for these women, and I would like them to define that, you know, what restitution looks like for them. They're never going to get back what they lost in these, like, very critical years, these formative years in their lives. So I believe that if the criminal justice system can find him guilty, then so be it. I also believe in social death, you know. I believe in boycott and divestment and sanctions. It's been a practice of mine since I became political around South Africa as a 12-year-old. So I believe in that practice, and I think that he's someone that we should have turned away a long time ago.
Is there any plan for a follow-up to this documentary?
Absolutely not. I can't imagine. This was one of the darkest years of my life working on this. And I say that with all respect to the survivors who've lived with this for a lot longer than me.
Thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you, Jelani.
Filmmaker and critic Dream Hampton speaking with The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb about the documentary Surviving R. Kelly. You can find it on streaming services. Kelly and his lawyers have denied the charges in Hampton's film. A Georgia district attorney is now investigating Kelly. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Denise Ho was one of the biggest pop stars in China. She played stadiums, she was in movies, she advertised brands like Motorola and Yves Saint Laurent all over Asia.
Denise Ho is a singer of cantopop, which means that she performs in the Chinese dialect of Cantonese. At her peak, she was one of the top-selling female artists in Hong Kong and played all over mainland China and Taiwan, basically any countries with a large Chinese emigre population.
That's staff writer Jiang Fan, who recently profiled Denise Ho.
And then 2014 rolls around, and students and activists took to the streets to ask for a more democratic process, and Denise joined them in their fight for universal suffrage. The protests, which sprung up in various neighborhoods throughout Hong Kong, became known as the Umbrella Movement. And the umbrella was a powerful symbol because it was a tool that protesters used to defend themselves against the tear gas that police officers were spraying on them. Denise was arrested on national television and became an enduring image of the struggle for democracy. Before the Umbrella Movement, Denise Ho was earning about 80% of her income from mainland China, where she is now prohibited from performing and where her music has been completely scrubbed from the internet.
Now Denise Ho is trying to reinvent herself as something like a countercultural songwriter, all under the very watchful eye of the Chinese government. Here's Jiang Fan speaking with Denise Ho.
So you grew up in Hong Kong and you moved to Montreal at age 11.
Right.
And then you moved back to Hong Kong to pursue your singing career. Did being away from Hong Kong for almost 10 years make you see Hong Kong differently by the time you came back at age 19 or 20?
Well, it was kind of, you know, a dream that I had, I guess, during the teenage years to, you know, maybe someday go back to Hong Kong because...
Why was it important to you to go back to Hong Kong? Why did you harbor this dream?
Well, I didn't see myself singing, you know, besides Celine Dion or, you know, in French. Or I didn't see myself having a career in Canada. And so I was really update with what was happening in the music and entertainment industry in Hong Kong. My idol is this cantopop diva, Anita Mui. And she was some sort of a link between me and Hong Kong, I guess, you know, during all those years that I wasn't in Hong Kong. She was this very, very extravagant singer with all, you know, these costumes and she was amazing on stage. She had this showmanship that was incomparable to anybody else in Hong Kong, or even in the Asian, you know, in the Asian market, and that was what attracted me first. She was very socially aware. She took a responsibility to voice out her opinions whenever she saw something that she had to stand up for. Namely, you know, when in 1989, the Tiananmen
massacre.
Yeah, she was very in the very, very front of the whole movement.
Right,
that was something that I admired. And also that influenced me a lot without me knowing, you know, unconsciously.
Cantonese pop songs and Cantonese singing celebrities are known to be very beautiful, very glamorous. Mm-hmm. And many of their most popular tunes are catchy and sometimes thought of as formulaic and quite saccharine. But your songs have encompassed a much larger range of issues, everything from the lives of marginalized to even mental illness. I mean, you have this album called 10 Days.
In the madhouse.
Why did you want to explore these subjects that are sometimes considered ugly? Why was that important to you?
The whole journey started when I became 30, which was 11 years ago. And, you know, I had a great, according to me, I had a great career until then, awards and all that. I was starting to get onto that path of thinking, is that all? You know, is that all that I can do with my songs, my career? You know, just for personal wealth and all that. And so, yeah, that was when I started to think, you know, should I be doing more? You know, I just went to San Francisco last week, and I was really shocked when there were so many homeless people, and I guess some of them were, you know, they had certain mental illness, and, you know, they are just the taboo of every city. And so back then I wanted to do this album talking about madness.
Growing up, I mean, did you have any personal connection to, you know, either depression or anxiety? Or did you have friends who experienced any kind?
Actually, no.
Wow.
No.
Was there a song in 10 Days in the Madhouse that particularly stood out to you, or that, you know, is your favorite, you know?
Yeah. Well, the first song, which is "Qingshan Dai Ma," Thelma.
Uh-huh.
And it's about this girl who enters this madhouse, which for her is, you know, the society where there are so many different issues that seems very sickening to her. I think there is this part of the lyrics which is talking about, you know, people think that they are so strong and so normal and, you know, better than everyone else, but, you know, it's just basically everyone is quite lost, you know, in their everyday lives. In that project, we went to interview so many different people, and I interviewed this doctor, and he said, you know, Hong Kong society is actually the biggest asylum.
Wow.
Yeah, because there are so many issues and problems that we just bury and hide and drawers and all that, but like it's so, yeah, there are sicknesses everywhere.
In Chinese society, again, there's such value placed on decorum and your behavior and hiding things that you're not proud of or you think that society would not be proud of.
Yeah.
And that really segues, I think, nicely to what must have been a great difficulty in being a celebrity with a secret. Because you were the first major female celebrity to come out as a lesbian. And how old were you when you came out publicly?
35. Yeah, in 2012.
Right. And I know a good friend of yours, Anthony Wong, who's also a singer, had to come out. And it was, you know, all anybody could talk about it, you know, when that happened. What was coming out like for you? You know, how did you decide to finally do it?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't a secret, you know. You know, people.
It was an open secret.
They knew. Mm-hmm. You know, I had all these songs, you know, talking about gender, love, and gender issues, and which one of them was, you know, quite a success, you know, in the very mainstream pop culture.
Rolls Royce, right?
Yeah, yeah. All my friends knew, and
your family knew as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, my family knew, and even my fans, they were, you know, they were probably 99.9% sure
right.
of that fact.
By and large, I think the response was positive, right? I mean, you tell me how did the fans react?
Well, surprisingly, Beijing was fine with it.
Right.
You know, you just felt, you know, brands just observing.
Right, you know, they're very cautious. They
didn't ban you or anything, but they were very cautious.
Mm-hmm.
And, but nothing, you know, from the Chinese government, they didn't say anything.
Mm.
And so it was, you know, it was good days.
And then 2014 rolls around,
yep.
And it's the umbrella movement. And it really stirred up a lot of tensions in society just about the political fate of Hong Kong.
Right.
And you were arrested on national TV, and you were, I think, you know, the biggest celebrity to be arrested on national TV. How did that day unfold for you?
Yeah, there was this very big protest for Hong Kong to have the right to vote, you know, for our own chief executive officer,
right.
Which is, you know, promised to us in the basic law. It was written. We had the slogan that we 我要真普选, which is, you know, we want universal suffrage.
Uh-huh.
And so the crowds, they started to gather. All the public. It wasn't just, you know, the activists and the students.
Like, right.
And so I decided to you know, be one of the people representing this group of adults, and me and one or two others.
Were you aware of the tremendous risk that you were taking and how much it would cost your career and your livelihood? Was that something that you thought about beforehand?
Yes. Well, I was aware, I guess, partially of what might happen. The government, you know, they didn't listen, but we didn't think that they were that unreasonable, you know. And we didn't feel that, you know, what happened afterwards, where, you know, students got jailed.
How long did you spend in jail?
It was just like 12 hours.
Mm.
Yeah. It wasn't officially, you know, I wasn't officially in jail. We were just detained.
Right.
Yeah.
And afterwards, you said, you know, you partially expected and partially didn't expect. What was the most surprising to you in terms of the fallout, in terms of what you didn't expect?
Well, I expected my career to have, you know, changes to it. And I expected to be banned from China. But I wasn't expecting, you know, the fact that the government would react in such a way where the main goal is to silence,
of course,
everyone, and to silence, you know, especially the younger generations with fear, you know.
So much of your art is about bringing your music to an audience. But in the wake of this political stance that you were so brave to take, you've been banned from reaching the masses in mainland China.
Yeah.
And there's just a contradiction there. I mean, so much of what you want to give to the world is your music, but because of politics, you are cut off from reaching, you know, 1.4 billion people. How do you reconcile yourself with that particular reality?
Yeah, being cut off, to be very honest, I guess that is the only thing, you know, if you ask, is there anything bad coming out from this whole incident, is getting the message to these people. But still, there are chances for me, you know, as long as I am creative and I have my imagination, I can still get through to people, I can still get by.
The New Yorker's Jiang Fan speaking with Denise Ho, who was in Hong Kong. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Probably the thing that Donald Trump cares about the most, or second only to the wall, is China. With China, Trump has been telling the same story for decades. They bully the U.S. on trade, and American politicians never have the guts to stand up to them.
People, and they're laughing at us. They think we're so stupid, and our representatives are so stupid that they can't even believe what they're getting away with. They take our money.
And that's from all the way back in 2010. Now, within the last year, the president has imposed tariffs on consumer products and manufacturing goods, and he keeps threatening more. And they do seem to be having some effect on China's economy. But whether this strategy works out, whatever the outcome of this trade war, our business correspondent Sheila Kolhatkar thinks that it all might be missing the point entirely. Here's Sheila.
One of the things I noticed when Donald Trump would go out and campaign and rant and rave about China was that there was actually perhaps some truth inside the point he was making about that. There is a lot of imbalance in our economic relationship with China. There is a significant trade surplus with China. There's been a tremendous amount of offshoring of jobs from the U.S. to cheaper countries such as China. Trump is being very reactive. He's looking at things that have happened in the past and responding to them. What he's not really doing is thinking about the future and the way things are evolving and where the economy is going. And there is a very powerful rising technology sector in China, and I don't think Trump has given it 2 seconds of thought. They want to rival Silicon Valley. And they have managed to create a really vibrant, thriving technology sector. Having done reporting in China, I've learned firsthand that it can be really difficult to understand what's going on there economically as an outsider. You need a guide. You need someone who's in there and can really translate and explain it to you. And someone who's in a really good position to do that is Dr. Kai-Fu Lee. He's a trained computer scientist. He's worked for a handful of major American technology companies, including Google, Apple, and Microsoft. And now he runs a venture capital firm in Beijing, so he's investing in the next generation of Chinese tech firms.
I have, you know, 10 apps on my phone I can show you. You'll be wowed by all of them, and they don't exist in the U.S.
Can you tell us about what those apps are? I know WeChat is obviously one of them, but yeah, what are they?
Sure, I'll give you maybe three examples. So one is a consumer loan app. If you want to borrow money, open the app, and then the money zapped right to your phone. AI makes the decision.
Wow.
Without any human intervention. And the default rates are dramatically lower than human loan officers. Another example is this company called VIP Kid, where a kid can get tutored today by, say, an American English teacher in a very high quality curriculum. And of course, the biggest one is the WeChat. And WeChat is the giant app which probably consumes half of people's time. You can connect your friends, you can conduct business in it, you can use it to buy movie tickets and call a shared ride, you can pay with it. And that payment in WeChat has essentially eliminated credit cards, which used to be the world's best way of paying, but now has become a dinosaur in China.
There was this perception for a long time that Chinese tech companies were struggling to keep up with their American counterparts. But Dr. Li's point is that the Chinese tech sector has actually leaped ahead of the U.S. technology sector in a lot of important ways. One of the areas where they've actually jumped ahead is in implementing artificial intelligence technology. Dr. Li has written a book about AI and the economic relationship between the U.S. and China called AI Superpowers.
Actually, the top Chinese media company is a company called ByteDance, and they're a media organization with no human editors.
Oh, goodness.
It is a personal life. Think of this as a Facebook newsfeed on steroids. Now, I realize there are issues, concerns, but the average user time per day on that platform is 72 minutes, much higher than even Facebook in the U.S.
In your book, you mentioned that a lot of the most important work that's been done up until now in AI has occurred in the U.S., but that in the future, the most important work is likely to occur in China. Why do you think that is?
Well, the U.S. has invented the technologies, but this is not the age of Enrico Fermi, that a few scientists possess all the secrets from the rest of the world. So we've moved from the era of discovery or invention to the era of implementation. And who will better implement depends really on two things. How many entrepreneurs and engineers do you have, and how much data do you have?
In both cases, China is pulling way ahead of the U.S. There are some high-level figures in the tech world in the U.S. who have expressed concern with how determined and ambitious a lot of Chinese tech workers seem to be. Dr. Li points out there's also a real cultural difference between a lot of tech workers in China and those in the U.S.
Certainly, China is in a very unique circumstance that many of the entrepreneurs, or actually many of the people, have had families that have been poor for 10 or 20 generations, and they carry the burden of, as a single child, having to support two parents and four grandparents in their future. So it is understandable why the work ethic is really incredible. While I think China has some work ethic advantages, so to speak, it is not the primary thing. China has created an alternate universe that has completely different ways of starting entrepreneurial systems.
Dr. Li's point is that because intellectual property is not well protected in China, it is a very fiercely competitive business environment. While here we may be spending money on defending copyrights and there are trade theft lawsuits, over there, entrepreneurs and tech workers are just furiously working to stay ahead of their competitors. The even bigger advantage for Chinese tech companies is they have access to incredible amounts of user data from all of their users within China. We talked about the Chinese app WeChat earlier. Imagine if Facebook, Amazon, Seamless, Venmo, and Uber were all in the same app. That's kind of like WeChat. It's a giant repository of data about its users' friends, what its users buy, what they eat, where they go, how much money they spend, all collected in one place.
And that massive data can be turned into smart AI algorithms that provide a better user experience and helps the companies who make those software make even more money.
One thing that makes China very different, of course, is the role that the government plays in business. The Chinese government is involved in the tech sector there in all sorts of ways that we would never see in the United States. They provide financing to companies. They can help companies build factories in areas where people might be living by just demanding that they move. I mean, they can really almost wave their hands and clear the path for these companies to expand or develop or come into being in the first place.
The approach the Chinese government takes is what I call techno-utilitarian, when a new technology like mobile payment comes out, U.S. will tend to debate it and have regulation, and then the products come out. In China, generally, they're allowed to go out while the government watches to see if there are issues. The government will tend to let new technologies grow faster and not worry as much about protecting the incumbent, the credit cards, the banks.
Dr. Li downplays the Chinese government's involvement, which might have something to do with the fact that the private sector in China, where he works and makes his living, and the Chinese government are closely intertwined.
I would personally believe and argue that the innovative business model thinking is the primary contribution in China. Working hard is secondary, and then government is actually lower.
It certainly appears that our relationship with China is becoming much more adversarial. There's constant talk of a trade war. Trump's imposed tariffs on Chinese goods. There are constant threats to crack down on Chinese IP violations and cybercrime. Dr. Li doesn't think any of that is going to slow down the explosive growth of China's tech sector. The thing is, let's say China ends up winning the technology race and they end up dominating in AI. One thing we know is AI is eventually going to put a lot of people out of work. Not just factory workers, but all kinds of workers, truck drivers, accountants, people who work in banks, even journalists. Ultimately, both China and the U.S. are going to be facing some real social upheaval as a result of all these changes. And Dr. Li is worried about that.
Well, it's a moral issue that keeps me up at night. It's not a business imperative. I worry that the technologies that we fund, they catch everyone by surprise. People aren't given enough time to prepare for this shift in workforce. I think governments, if they react too late, they'll be forced to deal with it by just brute force means, like universal basic income. And if they only do that, then the massive number of people will not be starving, but they're going to feel a loss of meaning. Some people question if we could roll back, but that's just not possible. The technology is out there, so I think it's incumbent upon us to figure out how to reap the benefits and use those benefits to solve the problems. And we need to be more global and willing to share the findings as opposed to keep them as the so-called competitive edge. The progress of humanity is a lot more important than any small competition one country has over another.
The venture capitalist Kai-Fu Lee, the author of AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. He spoke with staff writer Sheila Kolhatkar. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. My wife Alice doesn't want to go to Chinatown for Thanksgiving this year, Calvin Trillin wrote in 1996. Alice has changed, I told friends when I learned of her decision. She's not the Alice we once knew. But then again, maybe she is. Now that I look back on those Thanksgiving meals, Alice and I and our two daughters in a Chinese restaurant stuffing down some particularly festive fare, like minced squab and lettuce leaves, maybe she was the one member of the family who was lacking genuine enthusiasm. Alice in this scene is Alice Trillin, and Calvin Trillin wrote about her for 40-some years in dozens of pieces in The New Yorker. Alice was so much a character in Trillin's writing that after she died, he got condolence letters from strangers, readers who only knew Alice as a literary character. Still, he worried that his portrait of his wife was somehow incomplete, and after a few years, Trillin sat down and wrote a memoir called About Alice. And then, some years later, this year in fact, Calvin Trillin adapted his memoir for the stage.
My previous brush with the stage was many years ago when I did a couple of what my daughters called one-ham shows. I stood on the stage and discussed a wide variety of subjects from childhood with my older sister, Suki the Oppressor, to a poem I was writing about George H.W. Bush's know-it-all chief of staff entitled, If You Knew What Sununu Knew. Tonight there won't be a variety of subjects. Tonight is about owls.
Bud Trillin, if you know Calvin, you call him Bud, joined me in the studio last week, and it was a few days after the play started performances in New York. You've done something that's, I think, reasonably unique in literature in general, which is to describe a happy marriage. The literature in every language is filled with all kinds of dramatic bad marriages and catastrophic marriages and lonely marriages. In a way, to write about a happy marriage, which you did in The New Yorker in many different forms, whether it was in your food pieces or comic pieces, you talk about her all the time. You were writing and portraying a happy marriage.
It's true. At one point, I said we might be on the Grey Line tour as the only happy family in Lower Manhattan. I guess it's a problem writing about it in the sense this play certainly would have failed Drama 101 because it doesn't have conflict and then resolve that and all that, and it doesn't do that. It's just more of a kind of character study. And I guess there is a disadvantage, but you have to write about what you know about. I didn't know about anything else.
But anybody that knew your wife, Alice, in your presence, only thought one thing. What did you do to deserve Alice Trillin? How did you possibly win her over? Let's be frank.
Well, we originally met at a Monocle party. Monocle was a magazine, a doomed magazine of political satire. And as its financial situation became nastier and nastier, the parties got larger and larger.
When I saw Alice at the Monocle party, she was wearing a hat.
I wasn't wearing a hat.
I can still see her in the hat, a white hat cocked a bit to the side.
I never owned such a hat. After I'd heard about the effect it had had, of course, I kept my eyes open for one.
Then I did some detective work and changed a few engagements and showed up at a party a couple weeks after that I knew she would be attending. I compared myself in the play to a lounge comic who has heard that there's a booker for the Tonight Show in the audience.
She's the booker for the Tonight Show.
Yeah, there was a constant banter about some of my favorite subjects.
Do you talk mostly about animals?
Well, I try to limit myself, but it isn't easy in New York.
You mean in New York, you run into a lot of animals that are just begging to be talked about?
Well, there's the talk.
And you fell in love right away?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, these things never are totally smooth, but yeah, I would say that I was smitten right away.
How would you describe Alice to someone who's never read about her or someone who's never knew her?
She was very outspoken. I don't think I was ever in a group conversation where she was present, where she didn't have something to say. She wasn't one of the people who sat back. And she was firm in her opinions.
Is this meant to be funny?
Well, maybe mildly amusing.
Mildly amusing.
How about rye? I'm often described as rye. I've decided that rye means almost funny, but that's fine. If you think it might be rye is fine. I'd settle for rye.
Rye.
Well, what did you think?
I think this is very funny.
You do?
Yes, I do. One of the funniest things you've ever written. Gotcha.
I think I should handle the jokes around here.
She loved beautiful clothes, and she liked travels and beautiful surroundings, but she had a sort of a contempt for people who spend their lives getting more material things and money than you could use. She had a phrase for that. She always said, they lack a sense of enoughness. And I wrote about something called Alice's Law of Compensatory Cash Flow.
Now, this is a very important theory, and I think people need to hear it very carefully because it's very important to grasp.
Alice's Law of Compensatory Cash Flow holds that not buying some luxury you can't afford is the equivalent of windfall income. So if you say, well, we didn't get that stereo set, so we could use that money to go to Martinique. And so then the other person in the household sort of pats his pocket looking for his wallet where that money might be.
At a certain point, the Trillin household enters your writing. Alice becomes not merely a human being in this world, but also a kind of literary character in the work of Calvin Trillin. When did that begin, and was she on board with it right away?
She was all right about it. I mean, partly because it wasn't very serious. I mean, I used to do this series, U.S. Journal. I went someplace every 3 weeks for a story for The New Yorker. And at one point, I realized that I could write a lighter piece, comic relief for me more than the readers, by writing about eating.
But I talked to Dr. Seligman today. He said that when you were in there for your checkup, you weighed 180 pounds.
And I think that sort of got so pretty soon Alice was the person who told me not to eat that much.
But given the fact that this is a long-distance call, do you think you might be in violation of some federal law on interstate appetite impairment?
If so, my community service sentence would be supervising your diet. It doesn't have to start tonight. Think of tonight as Mardi Gras, followed by a very long Lent. Have a nice dinner.
Alice Trillin in life was a much more substantial person than just the person who told you you're eating too much. She said, of course, that she came across in my stories like a dietitian in sensible shoes. Mm. I was giving a speech once, and I was asked, is Alice in the audience? And what did she think of that description? And she stood up and she didn't say anything. She just took off these fantastically expensive-looking shoes and held one of them up.
They weren't sensible.
They were not sensible
not
at all.
Not the least bit sensible.
And I guess that's one of the reasons I wrote the piece in The New Yorker when you called and said, were you interested in writing a piece about
right,
Alice?
That Alice, who had lung cancer many years before, had what essentially was a not a relapse so much, but the physical effects of the surgeries and radiation weakened her capacity to recover, and she died in 2001 around the time of 9/11.
Right, that night.
And we talked about your writing about her eventually. I didn't ask right away.
No, it was a few years later.
Were you wary of writing about her again in a period of loss and grief as opposed to the happiest days of your marriage?
Yeah, if you had called right away, I think I would have just said no. And but I saw it, I think, as an opportunity to expand on or actually sort of correct some of the stuff I'd written about her. I wanted to write about her as a real person, a substantial person, and who had a lot of not just accomplishments but wisdom and things to say.
For a long time after I found out that I had cancer, I loved hearing stories about people who had simply decided that they would not be sick. The thought that my children would grow up without me was ridiculous. I simply had to be there. Not being there was unacceptable. But I also knew that some unacceptable things happened.
You got condolence letters not merely from your friends and family, but you got loads of condolence letters from people who knew her from your pieces. How did they react to her death?
Well, most of them made me cry, and oddly enough, most of those were from people who only knew Alice from stories. There was one particular line said, I look at my boyfriend and I think, will he love me like Calvin loves Alice? I was sort of surprised at those letters. I finally said they may not have known her, but they knew how I felt about her. And they got that from this sort of sitcom treatment, which surprised me.
When I'm asked by young people how they might go about linking up with someone with whom they're likely to enjoy a long and happy marriage, I tell them, wander into the right party. That's what happened to me.
But thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Bye. The New Yorker's Calvin Trillin, about Alice, is running a theater for a new audience in Brooklyn. We heard Jeffrey Bean as Calvin and Carrie Paff portraying Alice. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.